have this slightly mislabeled. It says fired from the radio station, which is actually not quite the case in this episode of Shepard leaving a job at a radio station. And I have a probable date of August the 4th of 1975. Sound quality is not the hottest, but, you know, this is the AM era, and we take what we can get. And well, later on, when I cut out 6 minutes of commercials before your ears, I'll tell you which ones you're missing, because we're going to lose a chunk of them in order to finish on time. So we present now from August the 4th, maybe, hopefully, 1970. What did I say? I put the tape in the machine and forget everything. August 4th, 1975. Here is a more or less complete episode of Gene Shepard.
You are going to listen to the following program, and that is an order. You hear that? That's right. That's an order. All right, George, you know, I think that's the trouble is we're too lax these days. This is a permissive society. And too many people are allowed to tune away. And, I mean, that's that. To me, that's ultimate permissiveness. All right, George, in fact, you know, I hope you realize that that many a network has toyed with the idea of producing jamming equipment, which secretly and subtly jams the station and the channel next to their channel. And, of course, yeah, well, did you know this was done? Wait a minute, don't laugh. Do you know that I know I'm going to tell you a story. You never heard of American communication. You know, there's a lot of stories that the average American walking around doesn't know about the field of media. You perhaps are aware, just faintly aware, that there is no love lost between various radio stations. You understand that, don't you? I mean, if you think that General Motors and Ford fight it out, or that Exxon and Shell battle for every last drop of gas they can sell, you have no idea what it's like in the field of communications. I mean, it's trench warfare. I mean, I've seen radio stations where all announcers were equipped with bayonets, and they were under strict orders to gut anybody that shows up from the neighboring station. No, this is the truth. Now, come on, Pat, they'll relax you. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. Your job is to listen to the show. Okay. No, that's now, I want to tell you one of the most fantastic stories that I ever actually... I knew several of the participants, and I will not tell you what town it happened in, nor, you know, any of the other details, except to say that this occurred. Now, the violent anti... channels, for example, in various towns, television channels, they battle it out. I mean, really battle it out for the advertising buck. And there are very few more dramatic moments when, by one of those horrible coincidences, a salesman, a time salesman from Channel X, arrives at this prospective sponsor at exactly the same time that a salesman from Channel Y arrives. And they are both trying to sell 6 o'clock. Well, I want to tell you, I've seen scenes that rival, you know, some of the more bloody Anthony Quinn movies. You know, everything but, you know, breaking the bottle off. All right! You know, I'll come one step closer and I'll gut you. You know, no way. Now, I'm going to tell you a little story that may that may really surprise you. The battle is more than personal. It becomes electronic in some of the more subtle infighting that I have seen. I will describe to you a town... not in the East, so it's okay. Don't say, oh, I know who he's talking about. You do not know who I'm talking about. This is a town out in the Midwest. And by the way, not a town that I worked in. So if you think, oh, I know where it is. No, you don't know where it is. I will give you this clue. It is in the upper Midwest. By the way, most people in New York believe the Midwest starts roughly around Harrisburg. you, of course, realize that in for example, Pierre, South Dakota, or say, a place like, the Badlands. They consider themselves living in the Midwest. Did you know that? Are you aware that's the true Midwest? the true Midwest is, say, Duluth. It is not Pittsburgh. In fact, to a Midwesterner, the Midwest ends and begins, really. The beginning of the Midwest is roughly Chicago. Anything east of Chicago is the East, which means Cleveland is the East. I've heard Cleveland discussed as a typical Midwestern city by... yes, in fact, are you curious where? Recently on NBC News. I've heard, for example, Cincinnati discussed as a Midwestern town. Nothing could be further from the truth. But as you hit the real Midwest, which is the beginning of the prairies, roughly St. Louis on, out to probably roughly the Rockies, that's the Midwest, the great barrel of the Midwest. Well, anyway, in a town in the upper Midwest, there were several newspapers in town. Okay? Now, everything was happy in that town because all the newspapers were owned by one guy. We'll, for argument's sake, call him C.G. Bullard, known among his closer acquaintances as Fang Bullard. Now C.G. Bullard, he was known for one thing. He pulled his own teeth, and he was very proud of it. Where others had to go to the dentist, he himself personally, sitting at his desk, would just pull a molar right out when it was giving him trouble. And there's a man of guts and vision. And his family was part of a pioneer family, which was proud of the fact that in one season alone, they personally executed over 45 sheep herders that tried to get into that same county to use the same grass that they were using. It was that kind of a family. Mean. Okay. Now, Mr. Bullard, and such is not his name, friends. Mr. Bullard, I repeat, to take us off the hook, if there are any, by any chance, any Fang Bullards who own radio stations in the Midwest, which would not surprise me one damn bit. I've worked for several. But nevertheless, Fang, yes, I'll tell you about the guy I work for. You want to hear about some of the most fantastic people in the world are in the field of media. I once worked for a guy that owned a television and a radio station, and he was very, very conscious of the fact. In fact, he was very self-conscious of the fact that he was roughly, and I'm not exaggerating, he was roughly 4 feet 9 inches tall. He's a little tiny guy. All right, so, you know, some guys are 7 feet 9, other guys are 4 feet 9. He was 4 feet 9, but he was very conscious of this. So this bothered him very much, very much. And obviously, from the time he was a kid, you know, he felt like he was one of the outsiders. You know, everybody's down there playing volleyball. And, of course, here he was running around among the ankles trying to play volleyball. And even kids who were called shorty used to lean on top of him. See, so he was very conscious of this. So as he, like many people who are conscious of a physical defect, he was unbelievably maniacal in overcoming it. Oh, yes. Listen, all of history, they claim, could have been changed. Wouldn't have been what we have now, today. Can you imagine what history would have been like had Napoleon been 5 feet 10? He'd have been a nice, happy, fat Corsican farmer. But the fact that he was 4 feet 12 or whatever it was, yeah, roughly 5 on the button, he was a little less than that. He was driven to unbelievable drive. He was unstoppable. He was maniacal. Are you aware that almost every talk show host is far below the national average in height? Everyone, without exception. You could put Johnny Carson, you could put Dick Cavett, Merv Griffin, you could put all of those guys in your overall pocket. And they would have room, by the way, to invite Jack Parr in. Now, Parr is you notice the biggies? Parr's big. The big guys have slowly lost out to all those little scurrying guys that took over their shows. All started as guests. Oh, yes, you put that, you let that rat in your bosom, buddy, and he'll eat you. Who are the big guys? Well, Steve Allen, he's about 6 feet 4. Yeah, Allen's a big guy. Jack Parr is about 6'2 or 3. And all these guys, you know, old Dave Garraway is about 6 feet nine, and replaced by 4 feet 2 inch Barbara Walters. So it's the little people, the angry little people. See, they're angry from the time they were kids. You know, they were every time they said, all right, well, are you guys out for basketball? Forget it. Little Clifford, you know, he was lucky if he could, you know, if he get out with a checker team, and even then, you know, he had to put phone books so he could see the table. So. He was very angry. Well, this guy was a very angry man. Oh, I mean, he was really angry. He was always angry. And as a result, he was fantastically successful. No way you could stop this guy. And I'm serious, he was 4 feet nine. And so, but he had to have symbols of his bigness now. He became big financially in every other way. He owned television stations, radio stations. He owned half of the state. He owned, it was reputed that he owned the Turnpike. I mean, yeah, I'm serious, he did. So here's this tremendously powerful, potent, rich guy. So to rub it in, he has to have an office. It was roughly, I'd say, roughly the size of the Felt Forum. And, yes, it was tremendous. He did. He had an office, tremendous office. And the office was very carefully designed. The decor was selected with absolute attention to detail. As a matter of fact, there's another interesting point. The smaller the guy, the rule of thumb, Shepard's one of Shepard's famous operating life rules of thumb, Shepard, the modern Machiavelli, the smaller the man, the bigger the office. The bigger the man, the smaller the office. It's the other way. Okay? So you find that the little guys generally wind up with gigantic offices. Did you know that Hitler's office, did you ever see pictures of Hitler's office? Fantastic. Hitler had an office, believe it or not, and it was in the Chancellery building in Berlin, obviously. And his office was designed by, you know, his architect, Speer, who has just gotten out of the prison here about a year or two ago. Speer wrote a book about it. And anyway, one of the things that Hitler needed as his architect and designer designed it for him was an unbelievably immense office. I mean, really big office. I'm talking about the kind of office that's about, 150 feet long and maybe 75 feet wide. And it has a giant ceiling that goes way up. And the desk, of course, that Hitler had was placed at the far end of the office so that as you approached Hitler, you had to walk through this long, vast stretch of emptiness. And way at the end was this desk, say, fantastic effect. Well, this guy that I worked for, now I'm going to describe to you the scene. It's actually true. And the people who ever worked for this guy get together now. They're sort of a little private club. People who once worked for this guy are a little club. It's like people who were once actually on the staff of Hitler in the bunker. They probably get together and talk about the old days, too, you know. But you remember the time he came in and, you know, that kind of thing. This is speaking of little clubs. This is WOR New York. And, you know that I'll tell you how funny this place was.
I'll tell you how funny this place was. It's actually WBAI in New York, and not that other place at all.
But the guys who finally left this place, there are places that are so terrorized by the company and by the people who operate the company that the people who are in the company itself have a feeling of being in some kind of army. See, the army, anytime you're in an army, the one thing about being in an army, you all together, everybody in the same army, have a feeling of unity together because their enemy is the army. See? And so there's a feeling of camaraderie which develops from, you know, from being subjected to a common enemy. And this is even more amplified if the enemy happens to also be, there's a war on. See? So if you're in an army and you have the enemy is not only the army, but also, say, whoever is on the other side, you wind up with a very close-knit group. Well, in the case of this particular television, radio, communications empire, when the people got out of this place, like, say, for one reason or another, you say, by the way, one of their great pride and joys was nobody ever quit at this place. They wouldn't allow you to quit. As a matter of fact, how they prevented you from quitting, see, was they had spies on the staff. There were all kinds of underground spies, see. So that if you're sitting down in the, let's say, in the lounge in a television station, see, and you said to your best buddy, say, Herman, and you said to Herman, "Hey, Hermie, oh, wow, am I excited today. I just got a call, see, from KLUCK. I just got a call from Cluck. But he really dug that audition disc, and I sent him a kin. He said, fantastic. It looked like it's going to go through." And you settle back, you know, on your duff, waiting because your show is going to go on in an hour, you know, and you're just cooling it a little bit. And Hermie says, I wonder if the coffee machine's still running. And he gets up and goes out of the room. Well, he's not out of the room 8.5 seconds when all of a sudden the phone rings in the lounge. You pick it up, and you hear this voice say, "Would you please come to Mr. Bullard's office immediately? He wants to talk to you." "Oh, no." And 5 minutes later, you're up there, and he says, "Get out! You're fired!" You say, "I'm fired. What for?" "You're fired! You've been doing a rotten job!" Down the chute you go, and their slate is clean. Nobody ever quits. And they're proud of it, see. Well, you're listening to the guy who broke all tradition in that company. I'm telling you, you're listening to an actual legend. And one day you're going to hear this when you're writing your book on media, Dave, that I am famous at this place. I started at the 7th floor. The day I decided to leave that place, see, I kept it to myself because I knew there were spies everywhere. I mean, see, so I didn't say anything. And the day that I decided I was going to leave, I went from the 7th floor all the way down to the ground floor. And I each vice president, I walked into his office unannounced, grabbed him by the bow tie, snapped it as hard as I could against his Adam's apple, and told him exactly what he could do with next week's schedule. Went from the top to the bottom, and by the time I got down to the bottom, the police were already on their way. Because the police were, of course, in the pay of Mr. Bullard. And the report was out that one of them is quitting. See, it's like the report gets out at Stalag 12 that one of the prisoners is burrowing under. So, nevertheless, I rushed out, and that minute I was a hero. It was fantastic. And so, to show you, though, how retrospective it is. Oh, yes, vengeance can be retrospective, friends. You do not ever escape justice in the end, ever. I will tell you how vengeance caught up with me ultimately in the end, and I will do that immediately following these commercials. Did you get that? Q, C-U-E, Q. Which are...
Assume that 18 people sitting around a table are all equally involved in the problem that the committee purportedly is about. Yet, every committee I've ever found, there's always three people whose purported aims of being in the committee are one thing, but whose real goal is being president of the committee. Do you know that there is now formed an emergency committee for the enforcement of open communications between concerned persons? Now, I'm wondering how they plan to enforce communication between concerned persons. Can you imagine this cop coming down and knocking you on the head, upside the head? And he says, "I understand you haven't said anything for the last 3 days. You've just been walking around silent-like." And you say, well, you see, I got this call. "Don't give me no alibis, Mac. We want to hear some communication out of you. And if you do not communicate within the next 24 hours, it's the slam."
A little bit of Gene Shepherd from his 1972 or so LP, The Classified Gene Shepherd. Thanks for Pete Delaney. Thanks to him for pointing me in the direction of that. As we cut out a few commercials, and for the historians out there and completists, here's what you missed. Theragram, Aero Mexico, a live reading of for a book about elephants by Shepherd, European Health Spa, and Corvettes. And now we're going to pick up the story. Well, actually, I think we have one more commercial here. We can't cut out the General Tire spot. After all, that's what WOR was all about. So we resume now. Gene Shepherd from August 5th, 1975. This is WBAI, New York.
Let's finish this little thing here by laying a general tire on the marks out there. Okay, right, hit it. And keep the mic open, baby, because I love to sing this. After all, this is Mr. Bullard's song.
Someday you'll own. Oh, oh.
Someday you'll own.
Yeah.
Sooner or later,
you'll own generals. Razzmatazz.
For 60 years, General Tire has been one of the leading tire manufacturers in the country, but they mean more than tires. For example, their one-stop car care center is staffed by experts who know how to take care of your old car, whether it's wheel alignment, wheel balance, lube, or oil change, mufflers, shock absorbers, braquets, or batteries. You'll get fast, dependable, up-to-date service using all these name-brand parts. They're all parts that are in your car, believe it or not, buddy.
So sooner or later, you'll own generals.
I'll say it again.
Sooner or later, you'll own generals.
Okay. Well, anyway, you want to hear about this guy, right? Well, I was one time summoned in the presence, and incidentally, they had a rule. Now, I'm going to tell you how ridiculous this the extent of monomaniac, or it really is monomaniacal drive that this company had, that everybody who came to work at this place, and I'll add this as a postscript before I tell you this little fact, that everybody who got out of this company alive, with their sanity, which meant not many, that many of them who got out, you know, and still could count up to 10 consecutively without, you know, just without their eyes glazing over and falling into a catatonic heap. Those people, they have a club now. I go to this club, see? And, yeah, they actually do. They have a club of people who got out of there. It's like guys that got out of Stalag 12. You know, they have a yearly meeting. And people have a yearly meeting. They hold it in this hotel in New York. We all gather and tell horror stories of the place we once worked at. And I'm legendary. See, I'm like the guy that escaped from the camp. And whenever I come, to this big roar of applause. And you know, the one guy that really busted out. All the others were fired, you know, in the old conventional ways, like clubbed. They would club them. When men were fired at that station, they didn't just fire them. You know, they would be clubbed with rubber truncheons. And, often stripped and head shaved and driven out to the street. But, it was terrible. But, I'm not kidding you. This is an unbelievable place. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you how mad this place is, that a guy recently wrote a book, last year as a matter of fact, wrote a book about the history of that particular giant communications behemoth. They wrote a book, and this book came out. And when it appeared, it was, you know, it was a big book. It was published by one of the major publishers. And it was, of course, promoted by the big television station, radio station. And when it came out, one of the reviewers who reviewed this book in this town says, how could they write this book? A whole book about the history of this station. You know, they had minute people that worked on it in 2 weeks, you know, and they talk about how they were here briefly and all that. It says, how could you write a book about this station and never even mention that Shepard was there for a year and a half? See? Well, it's George Orwell. You rewrite history. See, I had escaped, and I did it spectacularly. So I simply am now an unperson. I never worked there. I've been written out of all the history of the station. It's a fact. I've been written out of the history. So nevertheless, in spite of the fact my show, by the way, they had the highest rating, and you know how they get around that? My show had the highest rating of any show they ever had at that time, the TV show that I did at that point. And they merely said, a late-night show achieved astounding ratings during this period in the station's progress towards true greatness. They didn't say who the show was or anything. It was just a show. But nevertheless, it's like writing the history of The Tonight Show, and you don't mention Carson. A person that did the show was quite successful in making the, you know. So anyway, here's the kind of office that the head man had. Now remember, it was owned by this one guy. It wasn't a giant corporation. He owned everything. See, well, one day I was summoned into the presence, and he was legendary. You know, you never saw him. In his own elevator, by the way. That's true. There are many big outfits have, you know, their own special elevator. You had to have the code. And this elevator only went to his office, his suite. And so, anyway, I was summoned to the office. And I approached, you know, with great trepidation. I'm sitting down in the lines talking to the guys. You know, I said, gee, what's this about? See? And somebody says, well, if you were going to be fired, you would not be allowed to speak to him. Oh, no, part of the humiliation process of firing you, that's interestingly enough, by the way, there are some companies that like to humiliate their ex-employees, the guys they're going to fire, by not even allowing him to talk to anybody in command. You are fired by a secretary. Have you ever seen that done? Oh, yes, where some chick, you know, some 8-year-old girl says, oh, by the way, Mr. Cloverman, I have a note here for you. Here it says I'm supposed to read it to you. It says you're fired. There. Yeah, I've seen that happen. So that's the way they did it there. So you were fired by a total underling, you know. And the bigger the guy, like say some guy that was a famous news commentator, well, really famous, you know, somebody like the Walter Cronkite would be fired by a girl who was just hired last week, and now she's firing news commentators, and that would be what they would do. See, so he was fantastic in his creativity. He create evil. See, some people just have it happen. This guy created it, and he'd cackle as it was, you know, came to flower. So one of the things that they required in this behemoth was when you came to work there. Now this is going to sound like something you cannot believe, but it's the truth, absolute truth, that this station had manufactured, at great cost, I might add, and had manufactured radio-television combinations. They were like portable sets, like a 14-inch tube, you know, a little set, and it had a radio in it. You've seen the kind that have radios and so on. Okay. That everybody who got a job there had to buy one of these, and it was taken out of his pay. It was part of your equipment. Seriously. You had to buy this set. And it was taken out of your pay. Every week they take $9 out of your salary, see, to pay for the set. And the set, you got it absolutely, no matter what happened, you got the set. There was only one interesting thing about the set. It only got one channel. And the radio had no dial on it. You could not tune it. You just turned it on and you got the station. The station. And as a matter of fact, I might add how diabolical this was, that the station realized what a fantastic weapon it had here, see, in a one-channel, one radio station set. That they put them on sale then. They said, hey, it's a great, terrific thing, see. So what they did was take out ads in all the local papers, which they also owned. They took out full-page ads now that here you could get a combination radio and television set for something like $12. And the marks came down by the millions. They bought these sets, see. And so this is, how about that putting, how about, you know, putting the opposition out of business that way, you know, that's another way. So, nevertheless, this is, many of those sets are still working. They only get that same station, you know, that station and so on. So I was called to his presence. It was a fantastic moment. I'll never forget it. It was a very impressionable age, you know. I had just gotten out of college, you know, I was, oh, wow, you know. So I went down this long corridor. And he had, this was a tremendous building where there were all kinds of, you know, the corporation had all kinds of other things going. But his office was at the end of a long corridor that you walk down this quiet corridor with a thick carpet, mysterious doors on either side, marked conference room B, you know, stuff like that. And you walk down this corridor, and at the end of the corridor was a door that was different from all the other doors in that it was the entire wall. So it was a narrow corridor, and the whole wall was this fantastic carved walnut door with a great brass eagle or something on it. And that was Mr. Bullard's place. Now, it did not have a knob. You did not go in and say, open the door. No way. You came to the end of the door there, and there was a little ivory inset button that you'd press. And at that point, a concealed speaker would say, "Hello, sir," just like that, see? And you talk into it. You'd say, "It's me. Excuse me, would you please repeat your name? We do not know a Mr. Me." You say, oh, that's a whole clip. Well, this place was so Olympian that you just didn't say this is Cliff. Say, excuse me, Clifford who? Say, well, it's Cliff. Gee, you know, at this point you start forgetting your name, you know, because you have no identity at all. See, I'm Cliff Bugleman. And they'd say, one moment, please. And there'd be a pause. And then the door would open. Just opens. It's operated by motors or something. It just, but it's like a pneumatic sealed door. And the air rushes out, you know. And you go into this quiet place. Again, you're in a compartment. You do not just walk in. Totally glass sealed. And sitting inside a glass cage was an angry lady who apparently was also angry to the extent where she was heavily armed. So you walk in there and say, and they had a little hole that with a speaker, with a two-way microphone you talk to. You says, I'm here. She'd say, he'll see you. Fantastic. He'll see me. Say, she again presses a button, and a glass door on the other side soundlessly the wheels back. You are now in. Not quite. You went through another corridor. She says, that way. See, you go through another corridor, and she presses a button, and soundlessly a black obsidian door opens. See, it was a black door, just slides back, and you're in darkness. Fantastic. I walk in. First, I couldn't see because this place was very brightly lit at first. And this entire office is in almost complete shade. It's like gloom. Now, remember, this man is roughly 4'10". That's why I have to remind you of a very important fact. And at that moment, you know, I looked around, and then I began to adjust, and I see that the room is a vast room, and it is indirectly lighted through louvers-like. And there's little beams of light along the ceiling. But it doesn't make any on the floor. It's just kind of dark. And you see this fantastic room. And at the far end of the room, tremendous room, on a raised dais, must have been, I'd say, close to 3 feet high. I'm not talking about a little platform. It's about 3 feet high. Is this vast desk. And behind the desk, you could just see this figure. And he has lights behind him. Behind him. This guy, he'd read every known book on operational psychological motivation, how to cow the troops. And he had this light behind him, and you walked across this carpet that was, I'd say, roughly the length of Yankee Stadium. You know, you walked along this carpet, dead silence, and you arrived in front of this giant desk where you had to look up, you see, and you'd have to stand back. If you got too close to the desk, you couldn't even see him. So I'd stand back, and he's sitting at this desk, looking down at you, of course. He's way high above you. He's looking down, and he has a long ivory cigarette holder. I'll always remember that ivory cigarette holder. It must have been a foot and a half long, and he's smoking this cigarette, and he's wearing a pair of sort of purplish glasses, and he's this figure, you see, just sort of behind the desk. You couldn't tell how tall he was. Otherwise, he looked immense, though, behind that desk, because here he is, you know. He's looking down, and he's got the cigarette holder. And I stand before him, and he says, and it's sort of a high voice, are you Sheffield? And I said, yes. Are you? He doesn't know you. You know, you're just the star of the station and everything else. You've got 12 billion fans. He doesn't know who you are, you know. So at that point, he says, would you care for a French chocolate? I staggered back in. I was not prepared. But would you care for a French chocolate? Well, you know, first thing you can't say, hey, you're kidding, huh? You know. So at that point, he just takes this box. He just pushes it along the edge of the desk, and now you're looking up at a silver box. So help yourself. And you know, I reach up and I take the silver box, and here's a box of very unbelievably elegant French chocolates, the kind, you know, that are maybe $30 a pound, you know, that kind that come in little lace holders. and they're all filled with cognac and the Napoleonic brandy and all that sort of thing. See, so you don't just reach in, you know, just stuffing them in your pocket. So at that point, I take a piece of this candy, just one piece, and he knows them very intimately, obviously. He's looking down, see, and he sees this, and he says, ah, marzipan. I didn't know what the hell, you know, they just all chocolate to me. But he knew what they were, see. So I take the piece of candy, and I put the box back up. And he said, oh, yes, so you're a shepherd, of course. And he has a piece of paper. And he says, I wish for you to sign this paper. And he hands me a paper. And I look at the paper, and I said, well, what is it? He says, well, you just signed. And I said, well, may I look at it, please? He said, well, it's just a contract. You just sign it. It was a contract for 3 years. That's like being called by the Pope and you've now been appointed the head of all the cardinals. In other words, he personally is saying, I want you to be here for the next 3 years. Personal. Well, I didn't want to be there. See, already in my head. Here I am, you know, I'm faced with a fantastic moment of truth. See, what are you going to do? So I said, well, gee, Mr. Bullard, I can't read in the dark here, and I'd like to look it over first. He says, it's a very good contract. Are you suggesting that we wouldn't give you a good contract? Well, of course, their idea of a good contract, really, was maybe $12, $14 a month. Also, 8 days a week. See, they had a special way of calculating days there. And they were the only outfit I knew who could even play with time. They could make you work maybe 30, 40 hours a day. Plus the fact, by the way, you were allowed one weekend off every third year to celebrate the signing of a new contract. So, yeah, that's roughly the contract. See, so I said, well, gee, you see. So he then decided to be very, very friendly. And he said, of course, he said, you may sign it, but would you please give it to Mrs. Waring after you sign it? He says, I'd like that to be back in 5 minutes because we wish to keep our book straight. I said, well, thank you. In other words, yeah, I could take it out and sign it outside, see? So I take the contract out, see, now walking out, and that's Mrs. Waring in the front there. See? So Mrs. Waring looks at me, and she says, may I have the contract, please? And I said, well, Mrs. Waring, he said I could read it. She said, no, he said you could sign it. I said, oh, okay. I says, here, I'll give it back. So I handed it back there. She says, but it's not signed. And I says, well, I'll be back up later this afternoon to sign it. I have to go down and fix my show up. And I disappeared. It was that afternoon, by the way, that I made my decision, friends. Now, that's an absolute true story, but I'll tell you one of the more fascinating sides of that story. And it wasn't the same town, but another town in the same state. A radio station got so mad that the other radio station was getting listeners that it actually built on the outskirts of town a clandestine transmitter that broadcast a heavy hum at all hours of the day and night on the transmitter frequency of the other station. You could barely hear the station, but you could actually hear it. You hear, so some guy'd buy a commercial, you know, and he'd tune on his radio to hear it. It would go, Charlie's Paint Shop. Forget it. They lost all their business in about 8 weeks, and it took them over 2 years to track down the clandestine transmitter. And at that point, nobody built it. It just, they don't know how it happened. It was just magically, this automatic. So you didn't know there was things like electronic warfare going on among the machines. Well, did you know that early, now I'm going to tell you something really esoteric. In the early days of the Castro regime, did you know that Castro and the Castro regime put a jammer on this frequency, 710? That is a fact. That is an absolute true fact. And that early in the Castro regime, I had just come to this station, and I used to get fan letters from guys that were underground in the Castro government who listened to the show every night. Now, they didn't jam it because of the show, so don't think that. But many broadcast stations were jammed in Cuba, and this was one of them. Yeah, this is W-O-R.
This is WBAI, New York. That was Gene Shepherd from August the 5th, probably, or August 4th, I'm sorry, August 4th, 1975. And that concludes Mass Backwards for this week.